So today, it's my pleasure to introduce to you Professor David Kumon Kim. He's Associate Professor of Religious Studies and American Studies at Connecticut College, where he served as the college's inaugural director of the Center for the Comparative Study of Race and Ethnicity. He's also an editor-at-large of The Immanent Frame, a terrific, we call it a blog, but it's a massive site, a series of conversations and writings and blog posts on secularism, religion, and public life run by the Social Science Research Council. If that's new to you, I really encourage you to check it out. It's a terrific space for academic discourse on the topic. He's the author of the book Melancholic Freedom, Agency and the Spirit of Politics, co-editor of a Stanford University Press series on race and religion with John Jackson and Rudy Busso, and co-editor of a special issue of the Annals of the American Academy of Political and Social Science on race, religion, and late democracy. His current book project and the subject of his talk today is entitled The Public Life of Love, an examination of the status of love in politics, public life, religion, and the arts. His BA in History and Theology is from the University of Rochester, and his master's and doctoral degrees are from Harvard Divinity School. So it's a pleasure to have you here, David, and we're looking forward to your talk.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you, Eric, for this invitation to be here. You know, it's a wonderful occasion to come to Boston College. I want to just acknowledge some folks. First, thank you to Yael, right, for all the logistical help, and, you know, she's doing this great dissertation if you're interested in Charles Peirce, which you should be, right, you should talk to Yael. But also a good friend, Min Song, from the English department here at Boston College. And he was kind enough to host me here a few years back, right? It's been a couple of years, okay. And my friend and former student, Jenny Edgar, from, you finished?
One more year,
okay, we'll have a conversation. So Jenny's a student at Harvard Divinity School, but a graduate of Connecticut College, and a dear friend. So, you know, in many ways, it's very appropriate and compelling for me to be talking about the public life of love here. At the, how do you say this center?
Boise.
At the Boise Center on Religion and American Public Life. Much of my work has centered on this question about the status of religion and public life. Eric had kindly mentioned my first book, which was called Melancholic Freedom. You know, that was a meditation on, you know, the status and standing of freedom in contemporary life, which both that book and this book on the public life of love really reflect what I would call my arguments with modernity, right? So what are the costs to our lives that have come in modernity? You know, if we take, for example, freedom as one of the high ideals of modernity, and oh, God bless you.
Thank you.
Do you want a glass of water?
No.
Are you okay?
Thank you.
You know, it's something that has been consistently valorized and valued in modernity. And one of the questions I've had for a long time is, well, how enabling and what kind of access do we have to freedom, you know, after the great emancipatory movements had their say? You know, whether it's the civil rights movement, whether it's the abolitionist movement, the women's rights movement, and so on. Can we still invoke freedom with any sort of meaning and recourse? And if we can't, what are we turning to? And one of the arguments of Melancholic Freedom was that we were turning consistently, or seemed to be turning more consistently to the discourse and practice of agency, you know, as a kind of diminished version of freedom. Right, has resonance with freedom, has is on the same continuum as freedom, but there's something about we had lost something, you know, in the wake of certain successes. In many ways, the public life of love is a continuation of that line of analysis and argumentation. And it's really born of a certain kind of lament. Eric and I were having a conversation earlier about, well, why public love? Why talk about love in public life at all? This has come up for me for a variety of reasons. I mean, if I think about contemporary American political culture, I was joking, I was looking at, they have a little bookshelf in one of the offices here. It has a Fox News Wall of Fame bookshelf, you know, sort of Bill O'Reilly and Ann Coulter and Laura Ingraham, and of course Glenn Beck. You know, the thick, you know, the two thick parts are Bill O'Reilly and Glenn Beck. And you know, Beck had this massive rally. I don't know if you remember this in D.C. about 3-4 years ago. What's it called? Restoring Honor. That's what the rally was called. Restoring Honor. Something like 300,000 to 500,000 people showed up to this. And you know, in the concluding, we'll call it a speech that Beck gave. You know, he went on the screed against gays, against queers, against the poor, against immigrants, basically all of my friends. Right? and then followed up by saying, but of course our movement, what he meant, the conservative movement as branded by him, which would subsequently turn out to be things like the Tea Party, our movement is all about love. And so, you know, I was listening to this, I'm thinking, how do you make sense of this? Right, this dispatch on the one hand of what's effectively hate, dehumanizing public language, and then to follow up quickly by saying, well, this is, we're all about love. So from my standpoint, from my traditions, I thought, well, I'm not going to give up love to that. You know, this is a disputed and contested concept, right? And it ought to be. And it ought to be a contested concept. God bless you. What do we mean when we talk about love in public? What do we mean when we talk about love in politics? What examples can we look to? What, both positive and negative, I put it that way, right? Because one could argue that Beck was and is an important counterexample to the kind of public love that I want to advocate for. But what are the other examples? You know, Eric, oh, there's a picture. I never have slides, so it's good that, you know, my host provides slides. I mean, look at this image of King and Ralph Abernathy, and of course, the great Abraham Joshua Heschel there in the corner. You know, these were, this is a picture of solidarity, but it was also a pronouncement, a performance of public love, you know, enacted through the prophetic, right? So Heschel as a great modern articulator of the prophetic. Who are the undergraduates in here? Undergraduate, non-undergraduate? You should go buy, it's a small book. Right. Actually, it's two volumes, right? The Prophets by, you know, Heschel. It'll take you, I don't know, 2 years to go through, but it's worth it, right? It's worth it. Why? Because, you know, it's this very deep and expansive reflection about prophetic mission, about prophetic history, right? And so, you know, to me, like, the prophetic interventions that were represented by King and civil rights movement were acts of public love. But there's this question, do we have any contemporary analogies to that? We have any contemporary versions of that? Can I ask the young people in the room? I'm going to exclude you, right?
Yeah. Properly.
Yeah. Do you have experiences of love in public, in your public lives? Do you detect it? Do you feel it? It's hard. I mean, notice the hesitation. Notice, right, this is instructive. Notice the hesitation, right? You couldn't, you didn't leap to something immediately, right? You're kind of sorting through, well, you know, here's my music, here's my Kanye West, here's my, you know, here's my, the films I like, here's some of the books, right? Here's some of the political figures, here's some of the public figures. But it's hard to identify, right? It's hard to identify, not just a figure who articulates public love, but it's hard to identify a public example of lovingness. Right? I mean, we can think of analogies, right? We can think about kindness. We can think about empathy. We can think about compassion, right? And what is it? King came back to over and over and over again, like the strenuousness of compassion that was animating what he considered to be the beloved community of the civil rights movement. you know, what access do we have to that now? So, you know, again, like, to me, this is a project that is trying to, is scrapping for a fight, put it that way, right? It's scrapping for a fight for, about public love. I don't want to concede anything on this score. But I also see myself, you know, standing within both an intellectual lineage and perhaps a political lineage. So, you know, we were talking earlier about my teacher, my mentor is Cornel West. Right. And, you know, Cornel is, you know, will readily talk about love, radical love, you know, as the fire, you know, in which he engages in his public intellectual work. You know, I'm not the rhetorician that Cornell is, nor am I the intellect that Cornell is, but I have learned much as, in my own ways, about trying to integrate, you know, not just the language of love, but the embodiment and enactment of love, you know, in my scholarship, but also in my teaching, and hopefully in my politics, right? And again, you know, you're trying to think, so it's important not to say, well, you know, public love will just emerge just out of me and my experience. One has to think about one's roots, right? One has to think about one's forebears. You know, I come out of certain Christian traditions, but I also come out of certain Confucian traditions. Right? And Confucianism is an interesting ethical system where you don't get a lot of talk about love. You get a lot of talk about humanism, right, and the human, but you don't get a lot of talk about love. But I do have learned things about public love from Confucianism. For example, you know, the system of ethical reciprocity, otherwise known as filial piety, right? Which is what? Deep commitments and obligations that we have to those, to that, whether they're family, community, our people, right? And our people can extend in an expansive way to humanity. That's part of my spiritual tradition, but the other part is a Christian tradition, you know, where the teachings of Jesus, the teachings out of Matthew, you know, the least among us, right? You know, that it's not just it's not just a declaration, but it's an imperative, right? To prioritize the least among us, but then to find that, you know, translated back. I mean, Eric and I were talking. You know, he's interested in political theory and also law and religion. I'm sort of a lapsed political theorist, right? You know, which is to say, like, I work with political theory, and but I find that the discourses in political theory to be a bit anemic, right? You know, in large part because they don't draw deeply from these religious traditions. They don't engage religion in non-instrumental terms, right? Or if they do, they're saying, like, huh, I was looking for a virtue somewhere. Oh, Catholicism's got some virtues, right? You know, so they kind of smuggle some stuff over, right? So, you know, again, like, I have lots of questions about the viability of a project to try to recuperate and revive public love. And one of the really enticing things about today's occasion for me is to get some conversation going. Right. How might we think about, how might you all think about this? How might you experience it? You know, I've had this experience of talking about this book project in a variety of settings. And usually when people ask me what I'm working on, I say I'm working on the public life of love, I get this response. You know, this kind of surprise and wonder, you know, thinking like, well, why would one want to work on that? Right. Put it another way, we value love, but we also diminish its significance. Right. You can, you know, attribute the talk of love to sentimentality. You know, we talk the talk of love as having no place in politics. The talk of love, the experience of love, as being a private matter, not a public matter. Right. And then when it finds its way into public matters, you end up talking about contentious things like, oh, I don't know, gay marriage. Right. But let's talk about gay marriage. much, right? Let's talk about breaching that false divide between the private and the public. And with love, it's not just the private and the public. It's breaching a divide between the intimate and the public, right? Because our most intense and important experience, I would argue, experiences of love are intimate ones, you know, between lovers, between parent and child, or in between, you know, oneself and one's God. And we were talking about Augustine earlier. You know, when Augustine talks about the beloved community, I mean, it's an extrapolation from his own experience of finding love of God within himself. You don't get any more intimate than that. So, perhaps we can open things,
yeah?
Do you want to start?
Sure, I'll start. So, thank you very much.
Of course.
This is such a both easily accessible topic. We all think we know something about love, and yet also a possibly complicated topic, right?
Yeah.
So, I guess one thing I might want to start with is what you ended with, and I find it a really profound question to ask whether or not what we know about public love is necessarily an extrapolation from private love, right? Mm-hmm. Are they different things? Are they the same things? Can we conceptualize what we know, what we ought to think about love in politics as a function of what I know about loving my children? Because on the one hand, that in political theory, as you well know, that can lead to a very dangerous sort of sensibility of paternalism and control. But on the other hand, what else can we do?
Right.
We'll start with an easy question.
Right. Leave it to the political theorist. Right. Okay. I think the struggle here is to think about these intimate relationships either as models or as analogies. Right. Mm-hmm. And so the analogy is like maybe the easier one, right? This is like the love I have for my children. This is like the love I have for my parent. This is like the love I have for a friend. You know, I mean, you see a lot of work in political theory, for example, you know, around friendship as the most amenable form of love in politics. You know, Danielle Allen's book, for example, on talking to strangers, right, where she says, I want to talk about love, but really I want to talk about friendship. I admire her work a lot, but in many ways I think the recourse of friendship is a little too thin. It's not because I don't have loving friends. I think the intimate relationships that we were talking about earlier are paradigmatic. Mm-hmm. Right? They're paradigmatic, meaning they're moral and ethical and affective points of reference. Right? That, you know, otherwise would be hard to understand what love should not just look like. And I want to be careful that we don't merely talk about these visual metaphors. What does love look like? Right? Because it's not doing love much service if we don't talk about what does love feel like. Right? So that the affective dimension here is as important as the appearance.
And what does love do?
And what does love do? Indeed. So you mentioned children. Right? You know, it's hard for me to imagine any conception of love I would have right now that I wouldn't read through my experience with my sons. It's just impossible. I don't understand love otherwise. Now, I want to also make sure that we understand the kind of love I want to advocate for is not simply uplifting love. Right. Hey, you're doing a great job, Eric. You know, really, I love you, man.
Thank you.
Right? You know, deep love can be strenuous. It can be difficult. It can feel like a burden. Right? And this is where my reaching to Confucianism is important, right? Because it's a moral obligation. Right? And the moral obligations the ethical obligations that we have aren't always about uplift. You know, like the joke that all kids should get a trophy, right?
Mm-hmm.
sometimes it's about discipline, right? A loving discipline. Not because the discipline is the end, but the discipline is a means to enabling a loving relationship. And again, like with children, if it was just about mere effort, I would have, you know, If I was merely about affirmation with my kids, they would be tubby and filled with Oreos and soda, and you know. But no, I mean it is this constant back and forth and negotiation, right? And I often have in mind, some conception of well-being, right? Welfare, right? not necessarily happiness. Right? And this is a tricky question, I think, right? The relationship of love and happiness. joy might be better than happiness, right? Because you can have joy in difficult relationships. Does that get at what?
Of course, yes. So let's open up the floor, and as is our custom, please introduce yourself when you're asking a question.
Liz Cinquino, Director of the Advising Center at the Social Work School.
Oh, wonderful.
So...
Actually, my partner John Jackson, who's a coordinator, he's the dean of the social work school at Penn.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you're talking about love, kind of like of people that you know, friends, mm-hmm. family.
Yeah.
But then when you talked about like what would an example be of like public love,
yep.
I was kind of doing the same research into my brain. And the thing that I came up with was the response to the Boston Marathon bombing.
Beautiful. Mm-hmm. I was going to go there too. Great. Mm-hmm. Let's go for it.
And so these are people that, you know, as they say, ran into the, you know, like a burning building, like a firefighter does, but ran to help people instead of like, you know, running the other way for their own protection. So these are strangers.
Yep.
So this is a kind of love that probably starts very superficial, like I don't even know who you are, and I'm helping you in a public way, at the risk of my own life, you know, etc.
Yeah.
So that's kind of different than you know, friends and family that you love, and if there's going to be some relationship or you know whatever. So
sure,
different, equal.
Yeah. No, that's great. So I I'm going to use that to talk about another Boston Marathon example, but let's go with this one first.
Okay.
What is compassion? Right, compassion isn't driven by self-interest as such. You know, compassion, you know, usually is to set aside one's conventional self, right? To suspend it, if you want to use that language, right? In order to be open to the other. Now, I'm not saying that there was a kind of calculated compassion about these heroic folks, you know, who dove into buildings, covered up bodies, you know, at the bombings. But I think, you know, after the fact, you could see them as acts of compassion, right? So then there's continuity there. That's related to, but not the same as, you know, the affective relationship I have to my children. But there is a question of the bond, right? Love requires an object, right? Love requires another. Right, even self-love, the other is myself. Right? So in the act of heroism, right, there might have been, you know, most of us don't consider ourselves heroic. We might like to think that we are capable of it, right? But most of us in our daily lives don't have a big, you know,
S.
an S or a K. I'm, you know, like a big K under my clothes, right? And we would like to think that we would be the person to run into the burning building or run into the face of danger. But what does that require? I mean, again, like it requires displacing our conventional selves, you know, to really do that. Because if you hesitated, I mean, then I would think, well, what are my kids going to do? You know, what is my wife going to do? My parents and so on. Right? And then you get into this utilitarian calculus about, you know, costs and benefit, you know. And I don't know, there's something about that, what do we call it, a snap judgment? Right? That I can sacrifice myself, I'm willing to take a risk and sacrifice myself. And I think, you know, that's the point of continuity. To love often entails, always entails some risk. You know, whether it's loving between equals, whether it's loving to a child or another, like there's risk. You know, risk of vulnerability. Risk of what? Being harmed. All right. And so there's that continuity with that. The other Boston Marathon example I was thinking about in regard to public love was the response of, like, who's going to bury the bomber? right? You know, there wasn't a funeral home in the entire city of Boston that would accept the body of the older brother, Zadayev brother. Right? It really pressed this question about her capacity to forgive even the dead. Right? Now that, to me, is a stress test of public love. Are we willing to forgive the dead? All right, there's nothing, you know, there's nothing more at stake with this guy. Right? He's already in a state of our most severe punishment. Right? Forgiveness, again, like, it's a stress test. Because what is it to forgive someone? It's not always loving, of course. Right? But if you're talking about questions of justice, right? We're talking about questions of rendering good in the world. You know, I want to entertain this proposition about forgiveness and love. And apparently the city was not able to forgive. Right? It says a lot. It says a lot. Yeah, thank you.
I'm Evan Goldstein. I'm an undergrad theology major.
Mm-hmm. What year are you, Evan?
I'm the senior.
Oh, good for you.
I had a question because you talk about... this Glenn Beck example,
yeah.
And it seems to me that what's sort of pertinent there is not just the particular idea of love that he espouses, but also the particular public in which he's espousing it. Mm. So it seems like if your book project is the public life of love, and
yep.
We talked a lot about love, but I'm wondering about how the idea of different publics and the way in which in the media landscape we're in, different publics can traverse each other and overlap.
Wonderful.
How does that enter into
this
calculation?
Wonderful question. Clearly, you're doing a good job at BC. yeah, I mean, so the plural is important, right? You're quite right. Publics. you know, I'm tempted to think a little bit about Michael Warner and the notion of the counterpublic here, right? Where the counterpublic is out in public, but it's a kind of insurgent formation. And it's tricky. It's a little unclear, even in Michael's work, how the counterpublic becomes a public, right? But I'm more interested in the plural part of it, right? So publics are not equivalent, right? They're disproportionate in terms of influence. They're disproportionate in terms of size and disproportionate in terms of inclusiveness and so on. but one of the things I think many, if not all, publics share is the aspiration for expansiveness, right? It's like we want our values of our particular publics to be generalized, right? I don't think, so I agree with you, like Beck was addressing a particular public, a particularly large public, mind you, right? But a particular public. But I don't think it's, you know, his public was going to say, we're going to settle for what we got, right? They're evangelical in multiple senses, right? We want to grow and expand. Right, we want to generalize our values as a public to the entire country. Not even that, but we want to insist that our version of the public is the right public. Right. So again, like that's a contested term. It's helpful to have slides. I never thought of this. You know, as a contested term, is to insist that something like King's Beloved Community, right, you know, might be a public that we could generalize. I mean, I was just teaching King yesterday in a class on religion and public life. And, you know, I made several points to the students, because it's good to do that. But, you know, I said, look, it wasn't called the Black Rights Movement, right? It was called the Civil Rights Movement, right? So the aspiration there was for the entire civil society, right? Not just a segment of it. And that the ambitions were wildly large, wildly expansive, but also dangerous. Right? I mean, at this point, one of the documents we read yesterday was King's letter from Birmingham Jail. I said, you know, he talks about justice, he talks about love, he talks about, you know, human laws and divine laws and so on. And I said, you know, King has to smuggle this out of the jail. He writes it on the margins of newspapers and pieces of toilet paper, and then the other folks in the organization transcribed it and put it into a document. What does that say about that message? It was a dangerous message. Right? So he was talking to a particular public, right? But again, the aspiration is for everybody. But again, it was a risky thing. Again, this self-sacrifice. But then, you know, and not without a lot of finger wagging. Okay. Remember how the letter starts? It's, "My fellow clergy. You know, why I'm in this jail in Birmingham. Why aren't you here with me?" Right. But thank you for that.
Yes.
My name's Dave O'Brien. I retired from Holy Cross up in Worcester.
Oh.
Before I ask my question, you might want to pursue that burial question on the Boston Marathon with the funeral director in Worcester who actually
did
the body.
Yeah.
And who, in fact, that was not his first time doing this kind of thing.
That's right.
Oh, really?
And he was an elderly gentleman and talked about why he did these things. It was really not very moving. Mm. The other thing is kind of the decentering of the public. Mm. Where I think of Norman Mailer's Army of the Night when I was young. I read that book, and at the end of the book, it's the Quakers and a hunger strike in the jail that become the center.
Yeah.
Or I was thinking when you asked the question to the students about accompaniment people, people who do accompaniment battle situations. There was a young man named Tom Fox who was killed in Iraq, and the night before he died, his journal, he's trying to figure out how to love everybody, including insurgent soldiers as well as the people he's accompanying. Just this meditation at the end of this life. But the other one is, for me, is important recently as I had the chance to sit in on the revival of the official effort to canonize Dorothy Day. And
we just talked about Day earlier today. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's great.
Maybe you think you have to go to the periphery to see this rather than at the center?
Well, but it's interesting. Like, you know, and this is my own parochialism. Like, Day to me is a central figure. Right? Like, and what is that? That's this imaginative leap on my part, thinking, like, well, Day ought to be the center of many of our, you know, meditations about the public. You know, I'm so grateful for these comments. One of the, you know, Paul Farmer, one of the co-founders of Partners in Health, his characterization of the work that Partners does, he uses the same metaphor of accompanies, right? That we accompany, you know, in Haiti. We accompany, you know, it's not that we're leading these interventions, but we're doing, so what does a good accompanist do? My wife's she's a renowned biomedical engineer, but she's also quite an accomplished accompanist, right? So what does accompanists do? Like, you know, you listen very attentively to the soloist because, you know, they're going to do their thing and, you know, they're going to take the lead, but you also have to have their back because, you know, he forgot a passage or, you know, he's lost his way a little bit, and the accompanist is there to help secure the situation, right? To give a background, to establish rhythm, right? Chordal structure, frameworks, right? So it's not just a sidekick, right? But it's grounded. Armies of the Night, I love that you brought that up. I love that you brought that up. So if you remember the beginning of Armies of the Night, so I think, is it Mailer and who's the poet he was with? They go to.
Ginsburg.
No, it wasn't Ginsburg. Darn, one of the Harvard guys. But in any case, Waspica.
Oh, Reverend.
Yeah. So they go down. Is it Miami? They're going down. They go down to Miami, and you know, Mailer's really nervous because they have to give a speech to all these young folks. And of course, Mailer being Mailer, he gets totally drunk off his gourd. Right. He doesn't even know what's going on. But it's this meditation, like he has to dissociate because he doesn't, like the young people want something. And he's self-aware enough in his narcissism to realize, I can't give it to them, right? I can't give it to them, but he wants to, right? And so like he wants to engage in this kind of public love. But he says, you got another flask with you? Because like, I can't go out there. But, you know, again, like the Armies of the Night was Mailer's interrogation of, you know, these counterpublics. You know, what are the, who are these counterpublics that are going to storm the gates? Right? Who are these counterpublics that the people of my generation, you know, Norman Mailer, like, that I feel their significance, but I don't understand it. Thank you so much for that. I really, that's wonderful. That's wonderful. Yeah, please.
Dr. Kim, I've got a question regarding globalization.
Oh.
What happens?
These are small topics. Thank you. Okay.
It just presses upon us because what happens when you encounter systems, for want of a better term, Taliban or ISIL or whatever, which are totally loveless, where love seems not to be present at all?
Mm.
What does one do? How do you think about
that? Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, I had a conversation recently. I'm sorry, let me qualify this. One of the chapters in the book is going to be about the Occupy movement.
Okay.
Right? And so the Occupy movement as an example or, you know, a test case about public love. And I was talking to a fellow who recently wrote a book about Occupy, and he said, well, you know, I was thinking about different contemporary versions of contemporary, like 3 years ago, right? Like now versions of Occupy. And he mentioned ISIL. Right. And so it's an interesting question. I'm not quite sure it's loveless, right? You know, that there are, it's a hearts and minds kind of thing, right? You know, they're tapping into something. They're very savvy, right? And it may be a different form of love, which is to say that, again, love is dangerous. It can be dangerous. It's not necessarily affirming. It's not necessarily humanizing. You know, and sometimes it can be as much a kind of about chemistry, you know, as it is about a conclusion. But on the point about the globalizing forces that are loveless, I don't know. I mean, what else might I put on that list? You know, U.S. imperial practices, right? You know, it's hard to think about the U.S. as a loving government if I'm in Kohar, you know, in Pakistan.
Well, see, there's one, human fallibility is one thing. A principle of lovelessness is another.
Mm. So you think that the Taliban and ISIL are dispatching with principled lovelessness?
Yeah, I do. But otherwise known as hate.
Uh-huh.
See, in other words, if hate is real, love is real.
Mm.
So how do you deal with that? I mean, when it would appear to be pure hate.
Mm.
See, that's the problem, because there seems they don't benefit the people that they conquer, like Malula, Yusufzai, and so on. They seem to be motivated by hate.
I guess I'm less confident in making determinations about pure hate and pure love,
okay,
and pure evil and pure, you know, that kind of thing.
Okay.
You know, so that to me, like, public love is a disputed concept because I don't know what pure love looks like. I mean, I would say a discussion, but it was really an argument with one of my students yesterday about King. And he's saying, well, don't you think King's all just very selective and this, you know, this conception of love just comes out of himself and so on. And I thought, right, so it's not that transparent, is it? You know, it's like, it's not just a powerful, evident, you know, plainly evident example. And so, which is to say, it's not pure love. Right, you know, like you just, when you see it, when you experience it, when you feel it, you think, okay, it could be nothing else. Again, with pure, you know, I mean, it's not, I'm not a relativist, I'll just say this, like I'm not a relativist. I mean, I think there is evil in the world, right? There's most recognized as unjustified suffering, right? You know, the consistent dispatch of unjustified suffering is the problem of evil. And there are certainly agents who dispatch unjustified suffering. Right. Are they purely evil? I'm not sure. I'm not so sure.
Again, from a theological point of view, nothing's pure. Humans are not purely evil, but evil can possess them.
Sure.
They exist.
Yeah.
Right? In a technical sense, they're good.
Yeah.
But either the ideology that they're following is evil, but ultimately they're controlled by that evil.
Yeah.
So are you making your... You're refusing to make the statement that love is nonviolent, right?
That's the implication. Yes.
Mm.
Though, you know, you have these paradigms, right?
Well, you might say that love results in violence in active civil disobedience, mm-hmm. right? It engenders violence by putting itself in front of violent people.
Yeah.
But it doesn't enact violence. So in that sense, you might still say it's nonviolent in that context.
Yeah.
But if love also can be difficult and disciplinary mm-hmm. and perhaps lead you to do things that that are tough,
yep.
right? Whether it's a parent taking the child out to the yep. to the woodshed
yep.
Back in the day, or using the use of military
yep.
power
yep.
to do something you think is for the greater good. Put aside sort of imperialist yeah. ambition, but rather, you know, you might argue that what's, well, I don't
just
know.
War.
Give an
just
example.
Like it's just, it's
to
just
the extent
war.
That there is
yeah.
a just war,
right, right.
doing that, right?
Okay.
Are you... that can be love then? Those types of disciplinary, active, violent engagements can be acts of love? Because, I mean, the ISIL situation, it's hard to imagine
right.
How it fits well into a category of public love. I mean, it's hard, it's hard to imagine.
Right, this is very interesting, right? So, because it presses a distinction, I'm not sure it's a distinction to be had, but it presses a distinction between an act of love and an act on behalf of love.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And
love must remain pure versus
yeah, and again, you know, I could imagine a litigious conversation where that's someone say, well, you're just, you know, that second part, the act on behalf of love, is really
uh-huh.
still an act of love, right?
Mm-hmm.
Sorry. Let me go back to the intimate for a second.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I'm trying to think about this relation between violence and violation, right? Where one could imagine a loving intervention as a violation, you know, that is subsequently understood as violence, right? So violence not always as physical violence, you know,
mm-hmm.
violence as emotional violence, as psychic violence, right? And that... you know, the complexity of that continuity, you know, what it disturbs about our conceptions of love. If we say, well, violence and violation could be a part of an act of love.
Mm.
Right? And if you swap out the word violation and put in disruption, for example, say like an act of love is disruptive. You say, oh, yeah, sure. But then you say, well, an act of love is violent. In many ways, it is, right? If you're engaging evil in the world, and say, I'm trying to disrupt that evil as an act of love. I'm trying to render violence to it, right? Because it is against the purposes of the preservation of that evil, you know, that I introduce this love. Now, the radicalism of nonviolence, of course, is the radicalism of the choice, right? To choose, you know, to come of a people that have been systematically dehumanized, you know, for generations and generations and generations, and then to choose nonviolence versus violence is a radical choice. You know, and it's fascinating. I was teaching King yesterday, and it was actually quite difficult to convey the radicalism of the choice to my students. Right? You know, that one would choose nonviolence rather than violent resistance and revolution. Right. And, you know, I had to stop several times. I said, just pause and think about that. Just pause and think, and you know, what does that feel like? I mean, think about your own families. If someone had violated your family and your response was nonviolence, that's a radical choice. Right? And you think about, you know, so King learns and inherits this from Gandhi, right? In the face of empire. But where does Gandhi learn it? Gandhi learns it from South Africa. You know, these surprising emergences of publicness. You know, why in the world would nonviolence come out of South Africa and the Indian subcontinent? And then migrate to Birmingham and Selma. You know, these sites of massive violence,
We have time for a couple more questions, if there are some. Yeah.
Yes. I have a question about the thing you said at the very beginning.
What's your name?
David Trimble. I'm a PhD candidate in the theology department.
Oh, great.
He was talking about Beck. Mm. And just quickly mentioned that love should always be a contested issue. I'm curious as to whether or not you think that that's just because there's always bad understandings of it out there and we should engage it.
Yeah.
I think getting at perhaps maybe something a bit more fundamental about love always being contested because of the mysterious foundation on which it rests in a way. And I think that this imperative to contend what we think love is at all times has huge implications for public life, especially. It's always something contended.
Yeah.
It's never able to be politically approached perfectly. That brings us back to the risk aspect of it, and what like Kierkegaard says, if you feel like you should love, do it now, because you'll talk yourself out of it.
Right.
Especially as a group. You'll come to some reason why it's not a good deal.
Right.
So this idea of love is a contested issue, maybe you can say a little bit more about why that is.
So that's great. That's a great question. Even if in its better, if not best forms, I mean, my view is that love has to be dialogical in the following ways, or following way. That on the one hand, it needs to unfold in regard to certain kinds of humility. Right? Compassion is nothing if not a radically humbling act. Right? But paradoxically paired with confidence. Right. We love with confidence. You know, we don't love well when we love tentatively. Right. So, you know, that experience of fulsome love is an experience of confidence. And yet, we're constantly confronted with the thwarting of our love. Right? That's against the humility. You will learn this as a father. You will learn this, my love is a father of teenagers. My love is thwarted daily, if not multiple times a day. Right? Big embrace, stiff arms. Right? It's not that my sons don't love me, right? But that that my overconfident expression of love is humbled. Right? And I have to figure out other ways to love them other than the big embrace, right? But it's no less love, right? And so what does that do? That forces me to rethink and recalibrate my experience of love and to rethink and recalibrate my expectations and rethink and recalibrate my anticipation. And maybe this, and this is a Kierkegaardian word, right? This anticipation of love, right? And again, it's not always about affirmation. Like, the experience of love is often startling. Right? You don't know what you get. You want to come back?
No.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Hi, I'm Jenny, Harvard Divinity School master's student. So I was at Cornel West's talk that he gave last week, promoting his newest book, Black Prophetic Fire.
Mm-hmm.
And afterwards, he took questions, and maybe a dozen people or so lined up, and almost every one of them said, and a lot of it was in spite of Ferguson and young black men being shot and so forth. How can I have love? That was really the crux of the questions that were coming at Cornel West were, help me to love. And I think about, like, where does love come from? Because it seems that if love is unconditional, doesn't that in some ways diminish the quality of love? Like, if in the love is a, I often think of love as a relationship of reciprocity, in which we expect something in return, and when that reciprocity, as you said, is continually thwarted, from where does love, like, come from? Because what it seems
like... Yeah, we're already going to find it.
Exactly, because it seems like people were really at their end. Like, how can I have love for these
Yeah.
In the conditions that exist and persist. So, and in some, of course, religion is a resource as well, but I think I'm curious about, because I know that you've worked with David Dorfman
mm-hmm.
and the arts and things
mm-hmm.
like that, and maybe like arts as a cultural resource for love. Like, do you have anything to say about that?
Sure. But let me start with the example that you
okay.
So when those folks were coming up to Cornell, my guess is that they weren't saying they were looking for unconditional love. My guess is what they were saying, and I could be wrong, is that we want some evidence of love. Right? There's so much evidence of lovelessness. You know, help us even out the scales a bit. And it's hard, you know, like, you know, I've been to many, many, many talks. Bye, man. Of Cornell's, and he talks, you know, stridently of love. And you listen to him, you hear him give a speech, and you feel like, yeah, I'm going to have love too, right? It's available to me too. And then you leave the auditorium, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then you feel like, wow, what was that all about? I think what that was about is to kind of, oh, it's an awakening, right? I mean, we can walk through, and you know, Cornell likes using this language, you can sleepwalk through life, right? And you can sleepwalk through life such that you get used to not feeling love, not receiving love, not giving love. Right? The Academy is a good place to do this, right? By the way. But when your heart is stirred or awoken, and I don't mean this in a romantic sense, right? But it's open to the possibility that life might be otherwise. Right? I think that's what those folks, I'm guessing mostly young folks were saying, coming up to him, right? Saying, like, where is that love going to be? So you asked about sources, right? So Jenny was referring to, I have this long-standing collaboration with the great American choreographer David Dorfman. And I've done dramaturgical work for David and his dance company for the last, I guess, 7 years. And one, you know, one of the things that he and I constantly talk about are trying to make dance that shows where love is found in ordinary life, in ordinary experiences, right? Not the grand gesture. I mean, so it's hard. Like, you go to Cornell's lecture and you're thinking, I'm looking for big, grand, public, political love. I'm looking for our Heschel. I'm looking for our Ralph Abernathy. I'm looking for our King.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And, you know, in many ways, I think, you know, what I'm doing with David Dorfman, in other ways, and we were talking a bit about this earlier, is to elevate, right, and to celebrate the ordinary and the everyday and the ways in which we might find public love there. You know, given these might seem like banal examples, but I think they're instructive. How do we greet people? Right? You can greet them with a hey. Right? Do I greet you with a handshake? Right? But do you greet you with an engaging handshake, right? Those can be acts of love, or it can be understood as acts of love, right? Respect, right? Respect. I mean, you know this, like people are constantly making fun of me for opening doors. This is just the way I was raised, right? But it's also, it's what do I call this? It's a form of social acknowledgement, right? That I don't have to, nor do I want to, put myself before others. Right? In the simple gesture of opening a door for somebody else. It's like, I'm going to show you, not just a courtesy, right, but a connection. And it's amazing, you know, it has happened to me everywhere. Well, I'll open a door for someone, and there's usually this kind of startled look, thinking, oh, and then a sudden, you know, I can feel that little connection with somebody, right? And it's affective, Right? It's not merely, oh, isn't that Korean man nice to open that door? No. Right? Because why? Because they feel humanized. Right? There's an affirmation of their humanity in that act of acknowledged respect. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
We need to wrap up. We've reached our moment. But that doesn't mean you have to go home at this moment. If you'd like
we're
to
all
stay.
Living in the Boise Center
that's
now.
Right. That's right. We have extra food, but also I'm sure Professor Kim can stay for a couple minutes if needed. But first, please join me in thanking him.
Thank you.